Well, thank you for the welcome, and thank you for turning up. And I'm sure that a few more people will creep in as time goes on. Yeah, so, as explained, I'm Stephen. I'm delighted, or both delighted and excited. I was delighted and excited to be invited to give the Caroline Bone Memorial Lecture, the 17th one of those, and to join that list, which is an incomplete list given at the beginning, of stars and researchers. However, I'm going to start, and when I start my research, with something where Caroline, if I can call her that, may not have approved, and some of you may not have approved, maybe didn't even understand. But I care about the effectiveness of the education system. I care about its fairness, as suggested in the title. I'm considering different kinds of fairness that could be in the system. Obviously, there are 20, 30, 40 different principles of justice that we could all think of, and they would all be in tension in almost any context. Even the simple, obvious ones like equality of opportunity and equality of outcome lead you to different policies, different ideas. But what's fascinating from the research I've done is how universal it is people agree what would be fair in any context. So what I'm trying to work towards is an idea that although equality of opportunity is an important idea, I think there's a really big place for equality of outcome in our education system. And what I'd like to see is things like a minimum threshold of entitlement for things like literacy and numeracy, so that the state would put money into schools to follow students until they reach a particular threshold that's determined by society. And once we have 100% reached that level, we ratchet it up to another level for the next generations. And I'll explain why I think that over the next 35 minutes. So I'm interested in how to achieve the goals that I would like to achieve, and I'm interested in robust evidence. So for me, ideology is not at the forefront. But for the sake of argument, if when I press that button on my computer, we'd run that analysis on grammar schools, or on academies, or on free schools, if we'd found that the system as a whole benefited from it, so that the attainment of children was better overall, both those who attended grammar schools and those who didn't, and that there was no damage to society or social cohesion from having them, then I would be standing here as a supporter of grammar schools. I'll explain the situation later, but as a spoiler alert, neither of those things are actually true.
Phew.
In case you haven't realised. The point I'm saying, in principle, I could support them. And I hope you don't mind, I didn't know if you would have the projector, so I did produce a few slides and send a few examples of my new book. So the point about bringing the book is, if what I say doesn't make sense or you want to know more about it, the coherent version is in the book. There's an email address on the screen. I'm really happy for anybody to contact me after the event. It could be tomorrow, it could be on the train on the way home, or it could be in a year's time. I was one of those people on that night in committee room 14. Can you explain what you meant by that third point? Or I disagree with the fourth point. And I'd be disappointed if nobody does. So what I'm interested in is how best to assess disadvantaged school, especially in relation to attainment and fairness. I'm using largely official data sets here today. So that's the National Pupil Data Set, linked to things like the UCAS and HESA data sets, and a few other data sets are available. That means I'm looking at about 650,000 students per age cohort, and I follow them over successive cohorts from their entry to school to leaving school. There are no better sources for this. I won't talk about other sources because of time. The National Pupil Database is high quality. It's probably the best quality resource for educators in the world. It does have a few issues that are usually ignored, and I'm going to address two tonight. They are the fact that there's still some missing data in the National Pupil Database, and that causes problems. And secondly, that a lot of the data is only snapshot, and I think I've got a cure for that. But it means that if my results are somewhat different from other people's, it's because they've probably ignored missing data, even if they use the same data set, or they've used snapshot variables of people, whereas I'm going to look at people's trajectory throughout the school system. So the first slide is about missing data. I won't make a big point on it, except around 4% of pupils in the National Pupil Database, we don't know if they're eligible for free school meals or not. The DfE, in their wisdom, and probably by, you know, by default, have to assume that people who are not known are not eligible for free school meals. The welfare state won't provide the information, won't provide the lunches for them. But more importantly, for my thesis, it means that they're not counted in things like school performance figures. They're not taken account in the attainment aid scores. They're not taken into account by Ofsted when they go and inspect schools. They don't attract pupil premium funding, and they're not used in the calculation of the pupil premium gap for things like awards for schools that have done well. So although 4% is not a lot, you can see there that the gap between those who are eligible for free school meals, we know about, and those who are missing free school meal data is quite large. It's bigger than the gap between those who are disadvantaged, officially disadvantaged for being known to be eligible for free school meals, and the rest. So it's a serious problem. And you have to decide what you're going to do about it. What most people do is simply ignore them or treat them as though they were equivalent to non-free school meal children, which is absurd, obviously. What I tend to do is to create a new variable for missingness, and I follow that through, and you'll see that later when we look at a model. I'm trying to avoid the bias of missing data and take it seriously. A second issue that arises with the kind of data we're going to look at in a minute is how accurate they are. So I look at all indicators of potential disadvantage. So one of them, of course, is disability, learning challenges, special needs, and so on. If you look at this graph, the blue line shows the proportion of children who are born in each month of the year who are classified as having a learning challenge or a special need in schools. Now, obviously, the children who are born in each month of each year are very similar to each other. So, you know, there's basically the same number of girls, there's the same number of children eligible for free school meals, there's the same number of children who don't have English as a second language, there's about the same number of children of each ethnic minority group, and so on. So why are there more children with apparently with learning challenges, who are born later in the year? It is our friend the summer born problem. But what's going on here is that even professionals, doctors, psychologists and so on, are misdiagnosing what is basically simply immaturity in their year group and calling it SEN or something similar. And that's not the only example you'll see in my other writing. There are examples where it's practically clear if you look at the couple of variables in combination that one or more of them is simply being misused or something's being misunderstood. It means you can't take variables that seriously, always. Okay. Ethnicity, for example, may be worse. Can we have another slide? Here we go. Yeah, come for the next one. So, one of the things that we've never considered by inspectors and others is the proportion of children in schools who are have been long-term disadvantaged. And what you can see in that slide is that although there's clearly a difference between those children who have never in their 11 years in compulsory schooling been classified as being eligible for free school meals while in England, there is a gradient for every year that a child's been classified. So by the time they get to the age of 16 or 17, they could have had 11 years of labelled as disadvantaged in this respect. And this is true of all the indicators of disadvantage. I'm using this one as just one example. So what that means is that the longer-term poor, the longer-term disadvantage on any indicator generally do worse at school, even the people who had 1 year less or 1 year less again. Does that make sense if you look at that graph?
Did you say it again?
Yeah. So the longer a child has been known to be eligible for free school meals, or any indicator of disadvantage, but using free school meals, by the time they get to the age of 17, the lower their attainment is going to be. So there's a slope there. So at every level of entry, It also affects things like entry to higher education. They are about the people born, the people who have been flat, the long-term poor, not the ever free school meal or currently free school meal children, are about 15 to 20% less likely to get to university and about 20% less likely to get a 2-1 or first at university. Now, why does that matter? I suppose the crucial thing is, again, none of that is taken account of by Ofsted, like the missing data. What you end up with is that, for example, the amount of pupil premium money that goes to Kensington and Chelsea is the same as the amount of money that goes to Middlesbrough. I'm talking about per head of population. And Middlesbrough has a large number of children who are on long-term poor, and Kensington and Chelsea has a much smaller number. The majority of children who attract pupil premium in Kensington and Chelsea have only been temporarily poor for 1 year, maybe out of the last six. The majority of children in Middlesbrough who attract the pupil premium have always been poor. And that means that, again, with inspection systems, with the pupil premium awards, and with school performance figures, by not taking into account, there are misunderstandings about what's actually going on with school performance and other things. And I'd like to talk about later on how we could sort that out. It is not the case these longer term, the chronically poor or the chronically disadvantaged are simply scattered around the country. They appear in clusters in particular areas and particular schools. So as a snapshot, I cherry picked five local authorities there. So you can see that by the end of Key Stage 4, for the children or the young people who are eligible for free school meals, they've been on free school meals for six times as long in places like the North East as they have in some of these boroughs in the South. Again, they may be attracting the same amount of pupil premium funding, but I don't think they should be. Having more disadvantaged and longer-term disadvantaged pupils in a school means that, on average, we would expect slightly lower average attainment from that school. This average, everything I'm going to say has to be about averages. There are children who have been on free school meals for their entire career who've done really, really well, and in any indicator of disadvantage, that's true. And there are people who've never been disadvantaged who do very badly, as it were, at school. But on average, there are these poverty gradients in the results. Okay. It's also the case that the longer people have been on free school meals, the more likely it is that they'll have other characteristics as well. And I put two up there. So obviously, poverty is linked with ethnicity, and it is linked with SEND. This is not the same as the example where children who were younger in the year were misclassified. I think this is a genuine finding. And as you'll see later, a lot of what we think of as differential attainment by ethnic group is largely about differential attainment by poverty groups. And that's explained a little bit by that slide. So, what we're going to do about it? I'm sorry this is complicated, but you don't have to understand all of this. I'm going to talk you through it. Right? It helps me to put it up there, and some of you may be interested. What I've done here is technically what's known as regression. And what I've done is I've followed successive cohorts through school, and instead of saying, at the time they leave school, or at some earlier time, are they eligible for free school meals? Are they classified as having a special need? If so, what? Are they classified as having a particular ethnic minority group, being of a particular ethnic minority group? I followed them from the moment they arrive at school up until the moment they will take their Key Stage 4 exams and then on to university or whatever it is they do after that. So I followed them for as long as official data will allow us to check. Several things are noteworthy. What we're doing in a regression model is trying to assemble all of the possible predictors of people's outcomes in life. And what I've done here is I've fed them in biographical order. So what they, how they achieve, how well they achieve in English or maths or something at Key Stage 1 cannot be a causal factor in determining, for example, whether they were on free school meals when they arrived at school. But the reverse could be true. Right? So this is not a causal test. It's not any kind of experimental evidence. What it is an attempt to lay out a model that predicts from what we know about people when they arrive at school and then adding to that throughout their school life as to where we think they would get, all other things being equal. And the first major column labelled R is telling us, if you like, what proportion of the variations in outcomes, attainment outcomes in this case, can be explained by using the variables at each step. So what you can see is, by the end, by the time they get to Key Stage 4, before they've taken their exams, we could predict, we can use this value of 0.9, about 90% if you like, it's not quite that, but like, we can discuss it later, 0.9, to predict how well they'll do at Key Stage 4. And yet, we can predict with a value of 0.55 when they first arrive, when they first set foot in that school. I was quite surprised. I mean, I knew that it would be a large figure. I was surprised how large that figure was, and in a sense, how little it increased. Obviously, it can't go any higher. One is your absolute limit. And we wouldn't expect to be able to explain 100% of the variation, but that 0.55 is absolutely remarkable. But this is not measures of attainment. We haven't tested the children. This is not their sort of early year scores. This is things like the measure of family income assessed by free school meals, so whether they're on some kind of benefits, family income support, and so on. It's things like whether their first language is English, it's their ethnic group, it's particularly whether they have a particular challenge in their lives. So it's worth just thinking about that for a second. Prior attainment is also a key predictor. So you can see each step, I'm adding more variables in. What do we know about them when they get to the end of Key Stage 1, the end of Key Stage 2, the end of Key Stage 3? And I've also put in variables that represent who they were at school with when they got to that stage. It's not just what their characteristics are, what their attainment is, but what's the average attainment and what are the average characteristics of the school. And you'll see why I did that in a minute. So what it means is that each step can only explain variation that hasn't been explained by the previous step. If you just use, for example, Key Stage 2 scores to predict, that's 11-year-old scores, to predict 16-year-old scores, you'd find there was a strong relationship. And things like poverty, ethnicity would begin to decline, would decline in their apparent importance. But that would be a false impression for the reasons I've given. You've got to do it in biographical order. And just as a preface again, a bit of a spoiler alert, if you look at the end, step 11, we add the region, like are they from the northeast? Is the school they go to in the northeast or the West Midlands? And then what kind of school do they go to? Academy converter, grammar, faith-based school, community comprehensive. And what you can see is the R value for that step does not change. What that means, in simple terms, is once you've accounted for the different trajectories of the students and the challenges they meet and the kind of people they're mixing with in those schools, the kind of school they go to and where they go to school in the country makes no difference whatsoever. Now, what I've been trying to suggest to successive administrations, both in Wales and in England, more success in Wales than England, is that that's something that should be celebrated. What seems really bizarre is that successive administrations, and this goes beyond any particular party, but successive administrations in both countries, when they come in for 20 years, they've said, I've got a great idea, let's have a new type of school. It could be specialist schools, it could be foundation schools, it could be, university, UTCs, it could be free schools, whatever it is this month. Currently, it's expanding existing schools like grammar schools and faith-based schools. But it's always intended for only one part of the population, or some part of the population. No one's saying, this is a better type of school, let's use that throughout the country, which they could have done with academies. So if people genuinely believe that academies were better than the schools they replaced, then surely all schools would be academies. It wouldn't be ethical for a Secretary of State to say, I think these schools are better, and I'm going to only have 200 or 1,000 of them, and the rest of you can't go to them. Because everybody pays for the schools, and you know, everyone has a chance to send their families to those schools. I don't understand why that kind of finding, and it's not a new, particularly new finding, it's just the strength of it is new, why that hasn't been celebrated more in the past. I can't go through the whole model, I'm not going to go through every step. I'm going to show you two steps only, if you're okay with that. So, what these are, I'm afraid I don't have a pointer, these things are connected effect sizes. They're called effect sizes, imagine inverted comma. Again, we're not making a causal test. But they give an idea of the strength of the relationship between each variable and the outcome. And there are a few notable things on that. People worry about cross-border travel, they worry about ethnicity, they worry about first language. These are, if they are issues, they are at least temporary issues. You can see the effect sizes are trivial. They're there, but they're negligible. You can see the school mix effects, like the average poverty, the average attainment of schools, is also small, but all the results suggest that we would be better off having more mixed schools, both by attainment and both by social and economic background. So yes, those are very small effect sizes. Maybe, you know, you could improve results overall by 3 to 5% nationally. But my argument would be that would be free. If over 10 years we had a policy of simply making schools' intakes more similar, so there was less clustering of students by social, economic, and attainment backgrounds, then the country might, if this were a causal model, gain in attainment by about 3 to 5%. Mm-hmm. And international evidence seems to back that up. That would be the case. So pupils generally do worse in schools with clusters of disadvantage or clusters of high prior attainment. In order to achieve that, we wouldn't have to build any new schools, we wouldn't have to add any new money or employ any new teachers or build any new buildings or whatever it is, add resources. I'm not saying we shouldn't do all those things, that's not an argument against it. What I'm saying is it's there, sitting there, it's a prize which is small but available for free. Perhaps most remarkably is that things like ethnicity and so on disappear as you go through. Can I go to the next one, please? There's a similar slide for years 7 to 11, and then eventually you come to a slide that looks like this. I've had to cut it down a little bit. So this is the last step in my model. We've fed in what's happening in every year, all of the levels of attainment the children have. If you then take into account what kind of school did the children go to at key stage 4, or where did they live, and where was the school based when they did their key stage 4 exams, you can see that these are very, very trivial. These are not even like the school mix effect or the ethnicity effect sizes. These are just nothing. Obviously, negative means they're doing slightly worse, positive means they're doing slightly better, but I wouldn't read anything into any of that. What it's actually saying is it makes no difference once you've taken account of the kind of students who are going to the school and the trajectory and the challenges they've had up to that point. The type of school they go to in this national system makes it no difference. Mm. But then why should it? In a way, we have a national system. We can argue about how they're funded, but the funding is meant to be fair, but then with extra money for particular challenges, including the pupil premium. It's often inspected. The teachers are meant to have QTS. The attainment tests are meant to be standardised and so on. Why would you expect people to do particularly much better? And yet that's what successive governments tend to do, is to say, let's fragment the system, divide it up, and offer meaningless diversity. So that all of those different kinds of schools, and there are obviously many more than that, particularly if you consider things like the age ranges, 11 to 16, 11 to 18, 13 to 18, middle school deemed secondary, or whatever it's going to be, so many different types of school, they fragment the people who go to the schools, but are not making any difference to how well the children are doing when they get there. So I think that's a really positive result, It means that we could just have one kind of school, that you wouldn't need to have all the different kinds of school, and attainment wouldn't slump. That'd be my view. There's no evidence that schools in different economic regions or different local authorities have different outcomes for equivalent children. We can't ever send the same child to more than one school, nor can we randomise children to schools in a form of a large-scale experiment, nor would I suspect anybody want that. Insofar as we can match children who go to different kinds of schools in different kinds of regions, there's no sign of a school or a regional effect. That means all of the policies predicated on schools in the Northeast, for example, or the West Midlands, being bad schools with bad teachers letting their children down, or the old school-to-fail in Wales rhetoric, are simply wrong. And that when the CBI said we shouldn't bother with things like building infrastructure in the Northeast until we've cured the problem of the bad education up there, again, they're simply wrong. The problems in the Northeast are economic, as shown by the long-term poverty there, as opposed to some areas, and it'd be cured exactly by things like infrastructure and investment, and not primarily by education. Mm. Education often has too much sitting on it or riding on it. So politicians and others, including journalists and some academics, are crediting schools for their faults, as in the Northeast or some coastal areas, or crediting them with success, and I hesitate to say this here, but as in the London Challenge, which I don't think showed any success at all. Someone might pick me up on a question on that in a little while. But comments the Select Committee about a north-south divide in education and by the previous Chief Inspector of Schools, I think, are plain wrong, and I think the evidence we've seen so far shows that it's wrong. I think we need more and more targeted resources. Before any of you think, well, why do we have schools then if they don't make any difference? I'm not saying schools don't make a difference. It's a subtle idea, and it's one that the people who introduced the value-added schemes and Progress 8 and contextualised value-added, and again, this crosses administrations, didn't understand when they introduced it. Value-added, the kind of the approach that's used to judge progress at school, is a zero-sum operation. And it's half of the schools, half of the pupils, half of the teachers have to fail in order for the other half to succeed under that calculation. So the residuals that are calculated under value added are basically whether people do better or worse than their predicted scores. And they must turn out to be average overall, and therefore for every positive score, there must be an equivalent negative score. That means that all the schools in the country could be doing really well and getting better, and half of them would still have negative value added or negative progress aid, or all of them could be doing really badly, and we just wouldn't know because half of them would have good or positive progress aid scores. I think it's shocking that politicians can introduce a scheme like that and make it a law while it was still a kind of research tool in its infancy without understanding its implication. But I'm going to put to you another way of you could consider schools, only one other way. If you're thinking about the attainment of schools, what we're really interested in is not how does the zero-sum game work, but how much difference does going to a school, or to school at all, make to a child's progress? And we're lucky in that every year in England, children go who are born up to the 31st of August, and then the group that are born from the 1st of September onwards don't go to that year. They have to wait a year. Now, as we've already seen, that causes problems. But for researchers, it gives us an opportunity. Because at the end of the first year, you've got children who are very close in age, some of whom have had a full year of schooling, and some of whom have had no schooling. And you can then use the tests on those, and this has been done by my colleagues at Durham and by myself and others, to look at what difference does it make going to school as opposed to just growing up for a year and using, you know, the internet, watching TV, reading books, or whatever it is that people do. Now, the answer, you'd be surprised to know, is not as much as you might expect, but it is there. Going to school is better than not going to school, and people do better by going to school. It just doesn't... A lot of what happens is growing up, right? Maybe two-thirds of the variation is growing up, and one-third is going to school. But you can then use that scheme to work out how much difference is going to this school make, and you can do it in a non-competitive way. Because all you're doing is comparing children who are similar in age, who've either had a year in that school or not had a year in that school. It's equivalent to a randomised trial. It has the same power in research terms as that. It's completely ethical because no one's being asked to change what they're doing. We're just using the natural occurrence of those things. And schools can join together in clusters or federations or cooperative groups and look to improve all of their scores without anybody thinking, well, hang on, if they do better, we've got more chance of doing worse, which is what the current situation shows. The current situation, whatever people say and whatever people want about cooperation, means that schools are forced into competition, whereas they don't need to be. And that's this idea of looking at the age discontinuity is one way in which we could look at what different schools make compared to not getting schools in a way that's non-competitive, and whole regions can cooperate to improve their scores, whether or not schools in other regions do or don't. So what I would propose is we don't have different kinds of school. I think it's possible to eliminate most kinds of schools almost immediately. It's quite clear that what I refer to as segregation, which you mean the clustering of children who are similar, with similar backgrounds in particular schools, is made worse by having any kind of selection, covert or overt selection. Doesn't matter how you do it. So academy converters make the situation worse. Faith-based schools of all types, but particularly Catholic and Muslim schools, make the situation worse. And of course the worst culprit is those that select academically, the grammar schools. It would be possible, presumably, to eliminate many of these types of schools. Some of them not immediately. The faith-based schools would take time because of the land ownership issue and some of the historical contributions that have been made. But a determined government, a determined society, would look to eliminate them. What they wouldn't do is introduce new, 100 of these schools or 50 of these new schools every time. Instead of thinking about how do we improve the system, it's about how can we make it better for a few people or a few parents. And even then, as I've shown you, it doesn't work. It doesn't make it better for anybody. People might feel it does, but it doesn't. And that's what the facts say year after year after year. So we could just have one kind of school. If it were to be sponsored academies or the equivalent, maybe without sponsorship, or community comprehensive schools or whatever, it shouldn't really matter. My slight favourite would be community comprehensive. I think they're easier to understand. We've got an issue with the academies that they're chained are now absurd in many places. You've got them, they stretch, over 300 miles of the country. There's no cohesion, there's no community, whereas the idea of having schools which were locally accountable to voters there, I think would make a lot more sense. So I'd like to return to that. But what else can we do to reduce segregation? So these are figures, I'm sorry this is all a bit of a rush, but I'm trying to explain a lot of them. If you look at the orange line, this is a measure of the extent across the whole of England for all schools, how much children who have learning challenges or special needs or disabilities, those with a statement, that's the most serious often, are clustered together with others like them. And you can see what's happened over historical time, that actually schools have become more even, that they've become more evenly spread across schools. It's flattened out and maybe going up. But historically, the trend is good. It's not really because schools are that much fairer. I think two things are going on. Number one, yes, they are fairer because special schools have been reduced or abolished in certain areas, and those children have been included, as they should be, in mainstream settings. But there's also a larger number of people who have identified as having a special need. And what happens with prevalence, that is, the more there are of a group who are potentially disadvantaged, as children with learning challenges are, the more there are of them, the more they tend to be spread between schools. You can probably think of economic parallels for why that might be the case. And that's an important point when you come to look at the second line, the blue line. This is, to what extent are children who are on free school meals, eligible for free school meals, clustered in particular schools? And that hasn't gone down in quite the same way. It's a kind of bumpy ride. There's a kind of roller coaster, maybe a slight downward trend. Remember, these are millions of children over whatever it is, you know, 27 years of history. So these are big figures. So the differences, even when they look small, are quite substantial and would involve, you know, thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of students. Just as with the special needs children, it could be that as the economic situation changes, parents, some families, either fall into that net there for benefits or come out of it. And you can see, for example, that after 2007, the most recent recession, the segregation by poverty tends to decline. If you like, it would be what I would refer to as equality of poverty, that is, there are more of them, and therefore they're more evenly spread. Again, it's not because school admissions processes have become fairer, it's simply that some of the people have become FSM eligible in the schools they're already in. Mm. And some of the evidence for that is the grey line. Now, the grey line is simply the national proportion of children who were deemed or reported eligible for free school meals in that year. And what you can see is it's almost a mirror image of the level of segregation. That is, you can explain almost entirely how segregated the school system is from the prevalence, just as with the special needs issue. Thank you. If I move them along, because there was an indication that the segregation changes a year or two after the change in prevalence of free school meals, maybe the change in the economy, you get a situation like this. And loads of people are to look at good news. I'm going to point out one peculiarity of this. Yes, they're mirror images. But since about 2011-12, the level of segregation, that is the amount to which poor children are clustered in particular schools, appears to have gone down, but so has the prevalence. So real or not, the coming out of the recession appears to have been linked to not an increase in segregation, which is what happened historically in all other periods, but a decline. Again, it's not a causal model, we don't know exactly what it is. But one possibility is, and I'm going to investigate this much further in the future, one possibility is that as the pupil premium funding has followed poorer children to schools, their desirability for school allocation procedures, even if they were covertly selective, appears to have increased. Mm. So one possibility, and I'm only putting out there as a hypothesis that I'm going to pursue in much more detail with individualised data. But it could be that something like putting money to benefit poorer children not only holds the promise of increasing their attainment and therefore reducing the gradient we started with between those who have long-term poverty in the Northeast and the rest, but also that the school mix could actually be changed in the way that it's portrayed there by making them appear to be more attractive. I don't know if that's the way forward for school allocations. There could be other things we could do, but okay. So I've been given the notes to end. I will conclude there, and I'm sure I've said a few things that people want to question. Some of you will not have understood some of it. I'm really happy to explain more. But I will leave you with four possible conclusions. I'd like to see a national system where, apart from children, for example, who must be hospitalised, and it'll be a very small number, tragically, who will never be able to attend mainstream schools. But for everyone else, there should be mainstream school settings and that they should be comprehensive. As it doesn't have to be like that, but there is no evidence that any other school system works any better. And there's a lot of evidence that segregating children, as those schools do, by their background, by their ethnicity, by their the family income, leads to worse social outcomes other than attainment. So even if it doesn't make that much difference to attainment, and I remember there was that 3-5% anyway as a bonus sitting there, but even if you don't care about that, the evidence from both from Britain and internationally is that segregating children by whatever means leads to worse outcomes for all. And by that I mean things like aspirations, self-esteem, social cohesion, civic participation, people's later participation in education of all kinds. To some extent, it's just some people will have more or fewer role models. So that a comprehensive system, but that doesn't mean that all of the teaching in schools has to be in a comprehensive setting. What I mean by that is, it's quite clear from the work that the Education Endowment Foundation and others have done, is that there are children, for example, arriving in secondary school without the language ability or the maths ability to access the secondary curriculum, the wider secondary curriculum. So as one example, on the transition to secondary school, if children are assessed not to be ready, then there could be bespoke interventions for them. Mm. But instead of doing as it's sometimes now, where they get taken out of random lessons, or someone comes in and says, right, it's your turn to come to the special event thing, as happens also with special needs children, we could use that model. So it's perfectly acceptable today in comprehensive schools that children who have particular statements, who need particular interventions, are taken out of lessons, maybe on a Tuesday afternoon. What I'd suggest is the schools could simply have something like response to intervention for all children for some sessions. So there'd be a standard curriculum for everybody, but there could be, you know, the Tuesday and the Thursday afternoons. Everybody does something different. So no one's taken out of classes. You know, some people may have just go and do quiet reading in the library. But everybody would do something, and there would be at least temporary programs put in place until you get to that threshold where everybody can now access the curriculum at whatever level. Things like sports and other activities, you know, charitable activities, playtimes and things in schools can be for everybody, but just occasionally you have sessions which could be tailored to individual groups. For me, that's not selection, that's just common sense education. I would remove over time, insofar as it's possible, without great cost to society, the diversity of schooling. It's just unhelpful. I think it's the second conclusion. There's absolutely no need for it. It's becoming more difficult in the UK because we have now four home countries. So maybe I'm talking about England, but in England there is no need. The third one, I think we would want to have more funding for chronic disadvantage. So if the pupil premium seems like a good idea, and it did seem like an imaginative idea to me at the time, it may not be the best approach because it should really go to the children who have the biggest challenges in learning, and that isn't necessarily those who are economically disadvantaged. It may well be, and they may be more prevalent in that group, but there are some children doing really well, and in a sense it's absurd. But it's a way of funneling the money to the areas with the greatest need. What I'm suggesting is it should be calibrated so that more of it proportionately goes to areas with chronic disadvantage than to temporary disadvantage. I don't think we should be able to continue with Kensington and Chelsea getting the same amount of money as Middlesbrough or Sunderland or Teesside, just to take three examples, or working in the same as Manchester. I think it's just absurd, and I don't think anybody intended to be like that. I think it's just an anomaly or system that was an unintended consequence. And then I say we should set a threshold, a minimum entitlement to education and attainment for every child, and work as hard as we can to make that come right. So if in the first instance it was functional literacy and numeracy at the end of primary school, money would have to be put in to actually make it possible for some children to achieve that. So rather than having a simple, one pupil equals this unit of currency, we would have to fund it more temporarily until everyone's achieved that point, and then, as I said at the beginning, ratchet it up so that we could just get better and better, but remaining fair. So it's more about equality of outcome and equality of treatment than equality of opportunity for me. And I think that's what the statistics show. And I've run out of time. As I said at the beginning, if that didn't make sense or you want to know more or I was incoherent, it is all better explained than that.
Thank you very much.